from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Yesterday, the long hammer of the federal government came down hard on 23andMe, the Silicon Valley genetics testing firm known for its signature home testing device. In a letter released yesterday, the FDA excoriated the company for its repeated failure to offer scientific proof of the device's reliability and ordered 23andMe to quit selling it immediately. In a time when genetics testing and personalized medicine is at the forefront of medical treatment, the fallout from yesterday's decision by the FDA raises big questions. We'll take them up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Regulatory agencies don't often draft language that jumps off the page, but the letter the FDA sent the home genetics testing firm 23andMe, ordering the company to quit selling its signature home testing device, does just that. In extraordinarily blunt terms, the agency chastises 23andMe for its repeated failures to back up claims that the device it had marketed for 5 years was reliable. It details the hundreds of emails it exchanged seeking data, the 14 meetings held, the number of times requests for information went unanswered. And in the end, the agency decided to order the company to quit marketing the device because it feared the people might seek medical treatment based on test results that weren't yet validated. The FDA has huge implications, which we will take up during this hour of our program. But before we begin, I should offer also a personal disclaimer. I happen to serve on a patient advisory council at the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, which has an ongoing relationship with 23andMe, its founder, Anne Wojcicki, and her husband, Google founder, Sergey Brin. Let us begin. And we will start with Courtney Elias, who is the director of chemistry and toxicology devices at the Center for Devices and Radiological Health at the FDA. Courtney Elias, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
The letter is striking, and I want to begin just by asking you about that, because in it you say so often things like the company has failed to address the issues we've had previous interactions about, that we still don't have any assurances that this information has been clinically validated. Months after you began, you still haven't completed the studies, so forth and so on. How much frustration was the FDA experiencing when you decided that you had to make this order?
I think that you do sense a little bit of frustration in that letter because, we did work really hard to try and help the company bring their test to market in a way that was safe and effective. I'd like to start by saying here we actually do believe that there is value in having safe and effective genetic tests potentially even offered direct to consumers. I think that we believe there is a place for this type of testing.
And
do believe those tests should be accurate and reliable, and we weren't getting that information from the company.
Well, that's the point I wanted to ask you about. So we should not interpret this letter as a way of saying the FDA doesn't believe in the potential for home genetics testing. Your point is simply that you don't want that to be on the market unless there is concrete evidence of its validity?
There should be sufficient or reasonable assurance that the test results that people are getting are accurate and that people are getting sufficiently clear and clear information on how to interpret those tests and give information on what those tests do mean for them and what potentially they don't mean for them so that they can know how to act based on those results.
Does that mean in the FDA's judgment that there is uncertainty about the validity of home genetics testing?
I think, 23andMe in particular offers, hundreds of different types of tests. And, some of the types of testing that they do is well understood from a clinical point of view. Other types of tests that they do isn't as well understood. And in a lot of cases, too, some of the information is complicated. The traditional model would have those test results being given to patients in the context of talking to their doctor about them or potentially also getting genetic counseling to help them understand the results they're getting and how they may impact them and what types of decisions they should really think about. But what 23andMe provides is just, sort of an email with some information If that information is incomplete, then people may have a hard time understanding what the information really does mean or doesn't mean for them. So it
sounds like you have a twofold concern. One is whether or not this information is, especially in some forms of testing, has been scientifically validated, and the second being whether or not that information is being provided to people in a way that gives them enough understanding of what those results actually are.
Well, there's three concerns, actually. You just summarized two of them. The third is whether or not the genetic test result itself that you're getting is accurate. Whether if they say that you have a genetic variation, whether you actually have that variation, or if you don't have one, whether they correctly call that as well.
And outline, if you would, please, the reason why you had such concern. Give us an example of the kind of thing that the FDA was concerned about, that people might get this information and take certain actions.
Certainly there's some of the more high-profile tests that people have been discussing, like the test for women's risk for breast cancer. 23andMe tests a subset of the genetic information that's sometimes queried for these women. And the meaning of those results really varies by the women and their family history and sometimes their background. And so discussing those results with a learned professional is often useful in making valid decisions on the other end. Also, you need to make sure that the result you got is correct. If you don't have a mutation and the test tells you that you do, that really may cause a problem if you make high-risk decisions based on them. Another example would be for some of the tests that predict a risk of disease, maybe the information isn't really given in context. For example, if a test result tells you that you have a 5-time greater risk of developing a disease in the future, that may mean a lot if, for example, your risk went from 5% to 25%. However, if your risk went from 0.1% to 0.5%, that may not mean much for you. And if they don't give you that information, it's really hard to put it in context.
And just a last question. What happens now? You've issued this order to sort of cease and desist. They have 15 days to respond. Are you hopeful that 23andMe can get its act together in this next period of time and that it can continue to market it? Or do you see this as being something for which it's going to take a long time before 23andMe can actually be back in business?
Well, we're always hopeful that we'll be able to improve the communication that we've had with the companies, and where we can to work with them to get their tests on the market in a safe and effective manner. We don't know how they will respond, and we typically do give them that 15 days to come up with that response, and so we'll be working with them at that point.
Courtney Lias, the Director of Chemistry and Toxicology Devices at the Center for Devices and Radiological Health at the FDA. Courtney Lias, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
We should also note that the 23andMe is not commenting beyond one statement that they issued yesterday, which is as follows. We have received the warning letter from the FDA. We recognize that we have not met the FDA's expectations regarding timeline and communication regarding our submission. Our relationship with the FDA is extremely important to us, and we are committed to fully engaging with them to address their concerns. That was the official statement released by 23andMe yesterday. Let's begin the rest of our conversation. Joining us to do that, Hank Greeley. He is the director of the Center for Law and Biosciences at Stanford University, where he is also a professor of law. Hank Greeley, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you join us. Joining us, too, is Christina Farr. She's a health reporter for VentureBeat, which covers technology news in the Silicon Valley area. Christina Farr, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us as well from Duke University, Nita Ferhani. She's professor of genome sciences and policy and a law professor as well at Duke and a member of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. Good morning.
Good morning.
So thank you all very much for joining us. This is such an interesting and fascinating case, Hank Greeley, starting with the language of the letter itself and its consequences. What's your takeaway from what happened yesterday?
So I think there's both a short-term, a medium-term, and a longer-term issue here. The short-term issue, what blew me away in the letter was the FDA saying they hadn't had any communication from the company since May. That's like having a policeman behind you turn the lights on when you're driving and ignoring them for 6 months. I don't understand what happened in the company for them to not communicate with the FDA for 6 months. And I think the short-term issue is you've got to respond to your regulator. You've got to respond to the company. And I think that left the FDA almost no choice in this short-term action. The longer-term question is what you do, what the FDA should do and will do in terms of regulating home consumer tests. And we don't know the answer to that yet, other than that the FDA thinks that it is important for it to be involved. The longest-term question, I think, just over the horizon, so long-term here is maybe 12 months, what happens when we get to whole genome sequencing tests for clinical use and for home use? And that's the step, the technological step beyond what 23andMe is doing. That's coming soon.
And the consequence of that is so significant because that's where we are in terms of the forefront of medical treatment these days. It's all about that very question.
People are already doing clinical whole genome sequencing. The first whole human genome was sequenced about 10 years ago for $500 million. You can now get one for about $5,000, and people are doing it.
Christine Farr, as you survey people in Silicon Valley and in the technology field in general, what's the reaction? Was there sort of a gasp that this happened yesterday?
Well, a lot of biotech and health entrepreneurs I spoke with are keeping a very close eye on this case as it develops because it's relevant to them. And 23andMe is one of the most well-funded companies out there.
Because of all the Google money.
Because of all the Google money. So they have, you know, a legal team of in-house counsel. They have the resources to be able to fight the FDA if they want to. And I'm not ruling that out as a possibility.
Nita Farhani, what's your take on this initially? First, on the short-term question, did 23andMe just were they just too cavalier in their approach and response to the FDA?
I think only time will tell. It's unclear why there hasn't been any response to the FDA. I agree with Hank that certainly they should be in communication with the FDA. They may be taking the position that the FDA doesn't have regulatory authority over what they're doing, in which case it would still be useful for them to communicate that to the FDA. They may have wanted to see if they could force the FDA's hand and then potentially mount a legal battle against them.
What is your view on that question? Let's talk about that for a minute, and then we'll get into some of the deeper implications about what the FDA's authority is, because this comes down to the question, Nita Farhani, of whether this is a medical device, right? Tell us something about what the FDA has authority to do and why that definition matters.
So the FDA has authorization in this regard over devices, and they've defined devices and in 210 USC defines devices as being something in part intended for use in diagnosis of disease or other conditions or in the cure or mitigation, treatment or prevention of diseases. And the claim seems to be that because they've classified this potentially as a device and they've classified it as something that requires pre-market clearance, that the real question is it being used for diagnosis of disease or other conditions? And I think that's the challenging question from my perspective, because it's clear that people are at times using some of the information that they get from their 23andMe profile and taking it into their doctor's offices, and that's leading their doctors potentially to run some tests and to diagnose conditions. What's ultimately diagnosing their condition is the tests that the physician runs in the offices to try to determine what the person actually has. But, you know, the real question is any information that we can glean about ourselves going to be classified as a device simply because it can be used in diagnosis of disease or other conditions, even if the company isn't actually marketing it as a home testing device for that purpose?
So this raises, Hank, really this question of whose information is it, right? And whether or not people have the right to know what's inside them.
That's a deeper question that it raises. Once you get past the jurisdictional question of what the statute actually says, Nita and I are old friends, and we've been arguing about this issue for about 5 years, I'd say. And yet she's still wrong.
Hardly, Hank.
The device issue, the statute gives the FDA control over devices, but it classifies devices into classes 1, 2, and 3 based on how risky they are. So a crutch or a cane is a medical device, but it's a very low-risk one. And an MRI machine is a medical device, but it's a high-risk one. Mechanized wheelchair is a class 2, an in-between device. And what they're saying here is that it's not just the spit tube, but the tube plus the testing is a device in that it's being marketed for use in diagnosis and treatment. And if you look at the 23andMe website, I don't think there's any question but that they are pushing the health implications of it. They're telling you that this can be useful. They're giving you vignettes, stories of people who've made good medical use of it. So I think in that sense, to me, it seems fairly clearly a device.
Now, even those vignettes talk about how there's some information that they've discovered about their family history, about their genetic predisposition based on the sequencing analysis that 23andMe has done. And then they've taken that to their physicians who have then run clinical diagnostic tests such as blood tests in order to determine whether or not the person had a disease. So simply having some information which might guide you to do so doesn't mean it's a medical device. We're getting tons of information every day from things like health trackers that we're using, like Fitbit and Nike wristbands that tell us about our sleep pattern and the number of steps we're getting per day. Just because that information may be useful in a diagnosis doesn't mean that it is diagnostic information.
Let's step back for a moment and just be clear about what it is the spit tube does and what we get from that. So Christina Farr, tell us what it is this actually is that people could acquire, at least until the FDA put the clamps on it, and what it is that 23andMe has been telling people that it is.
Well, I think this point is particularly interesting. We mentioned kind of marketing and messaging here and what you see on the company's website. So they tell you that, you know, for $99 and just a little kind of vial of your saliva, that not only can they give you analysis and insight into various health conditions, but also your ancestral history, where you come from. And those, you know, two things are extremely different. And 23andMe is sort of marketing the entire package as something that they say is fun, and it's for people who are curious. But that implies, and I think the FDA is concerned, that this test is not something that's serious, that you don't need to interpret these results with your physician or a genetic counselor, that it is something that you can do kind of on a whim for fun.
So give us an example of the kind of thing you would find out if you take a test, and then we'll talk about what happens with that information.
Well, you might find out anything from your percentage of Neanderthal DNA to whether or not you have a high risk of getting Parkinson's disease. These are obviously, it's a wide range of discoveries that you can make. Another issue is that with, you know, the health aspects, 23andMe is a little bit more concerned perhaps about your privacy and encourages people not to share that. But for, you know, some of the more fun aspects, the kind of ancestral DNA, for instance, they've built out integrations with social media sites. So, you can log on to Facebook and see people sharing their 23andMe results. And I think this kind of aggressive marketing is what kind of got the FDA to take such urgent action.
So there's lots going on here, Hank Greeley, and I want to see if we can sort of divide it out and understand what we can about each aspect of this, starting with the validity. One thing that's not clear to me, I understand there's concern about people would take action based on the results. But what about the validity? I mean, is there real doubt that about whether or not these tests actually give you good information? Or is there real concern about whether or not this can be wrong? If you send it to one testing house, you get one result. If you send it to another, you get another result.
So the FDA spokesperson, I thought, did a nice job of breaking validity down into two parts. There's analytic validity. How good is it at telling you what DNA is actually there? And then there's clinical or interpretive validity. How good are they at telling you what that means? I think their analytic validity, although the FDA isn't satisfied with it yet, should be quite good. The technology they're using, the SNP chip, single nucleotide polymorphism chip technology, is old, well-established, and pretty darn good. But we know that the clinical validity for many of these things is very iffy. We actually know that because a few years ago, a couple of groups did an experiment. They sent DNA samples from the same people to the then three companies dominating the field, Navigenix, DecodeMe, and 23andMe, and they looked at the results. The three companies got the SNP calls, the analytic validity, right. They all were about the same.
So just to make sure I'm following this, each of these firms that did the tests gave you the same result. You have gene X mutation or whatever.
Right. You have an A here or a G here or a T here or a C here, looking at these single nucleotide polymorphisms, these markers for things. But they gave widely different views about whether it was important. A third of the time, one of the companies said for the 20 diseases they looked at that the person was at high risk, and another company said they were at low risk. Same DNA, different interpretation. And I think that's what the FDA has to be worried about. And I think that's a legitimately hard problem.
So, Nita Farahany, on that point, you could tell from what Courtney Elias, the person at the FDA, was telling us, that their concern really is a lot about not just validity, but as Hank Greeley is suggesting, interpretation. And 23andMe doesn't provide specific genetic counseling help. They make you aware of where you could get genetic counseling interpretation, but they don't directly provide that service. Is that a legitimate concern in your view?
I think it's a legitimate concern that we should beware of interpretations of genetic information because we're still very early in understanding what a lot of genetic information tells us. And one of the reasons why there were remarkable differences between the companies is different research studies tell you different things. And so 23andMe does a nice job of telling you where they're getting their predisposition information from, and they actually give you links to the different research studies that they are relying upon to make their interpretive analysis for you. I think that's actually one of my biggest concerns about this type of regulatory step. There is a tremendous amount of information that's out there on the web. And, you know, every time people get a sniffle or get a rash, they Google, you know, rash and, you know, on my leg and get a huge volume of information. And if the idea is that we should somehow be regulating all of that information, then we have deeply problematic issues beyond just the medical device issue. We have First Amendment concerns about the freedom of information and sharing information and access to that kind of information that will be implicated by this case. So I think it's right to be wary about all of the information that we receive. It's wrong to necessarily think that that gives the FDA the right to curtail the flow of information to individuals.
So does this come down in a sense then, Christina Farr, to your view of information and whether or not I'm a responsible person, I can deal with this, I can figure it out, or whether or not there has to be some regulatory supervision of that, lest you take an action that you will perhaps regret?
Well, I think this direct consumer model is very interesting, and it's sort of new. And at this point, 23andMe is totally dominant in that space. But, you know, even yesterday when I was doing all this reporting, you know, I spoke with neurologists, I spoke with family practice physicians, and they all had these sort of horror stories that were very real of patients in their 20s and 30s walking in with a 23andMe result, perfectly healthy patients saying, I want an MRI, I think I have Alzheimer's. You know, or an even more scary case, I spoke with someone who said that her son had gotten a 23andMe result, which pointed out that he had a BRCA mutation, which links to breast and ovarian cancer. And she then decided to have the 23andMe test and was now considering a double mastectomy, especially after reading that piece, the op-ed from Angelina Jolie. But, you know, these kinds of stories are everywhere, and it didn't take very long to kind of pull off the lid on that.
We must take a short break, and when we come back, we will further explore all of these fascinating questions. What does this decision by the FDA mean for the future of home genetics testing? What do you think? Is this information that you would like to have available to you? Do you think there needs to be more regulatory supervision of it? How well do we understand risk? We'll talk about all of that when we return. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. You can email us as well at kqed.org as we continue our conversation about the genetics testing future, not only at 23andMe, but on the field as a whole. What do you think? What kind of information do you want? What kind of government regulation do you want? We'll take all that up after we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic, the release yesterday of a letter from the FDA to the Silicon Valley genetics testing firm 23andMe, telling them to halt its marketing of its signature home testing device. The reason? The company had not provided to the FDA's satisfaction information that would guarantee the validity of the results that people were getting. And the FDA was concerned that people then might act on test results for which there wasn't sufficient validity. We're joined by Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and Biosciences at Stanford University. University, Christina Farr, health reporter for VentureBeat, and Nita Farahani, professor of genome sciences and policy, also a law professor at Duke and a member of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. We want you to join us too, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Hank Greeley, you wanted to chime in to what we were talking about right before the break in terms of the right to information, and to what extent should it be ours? Should what extent should that information and its delivery be supervised by the government?
Right. And this goes back to a question you asked earlier and also to Nita Farahani's recent comments. I think there's a real philosophical difference here, a difference of outlook on the world in terms of paternalism versus individualism. I'm on the more paternalistic side on this one. Nita's on the more individualistic side. And those are real and serious differences that probably you can't convince the other one out of.
Make your argument.
But I think in health, we are traditionally paternalistic for very good reasons. We don't worry about whether a new video game is safe or effective. We worry about whether new drugs and health treatments are safe and effective because people care a lot about their health. They don't understand a lot of medicine very well. It's very important to them. They're making decisions in often very emotionally complicated times and contexts. And we've had bad experiences with quacks over the centuries.
This is one area where you need a big brother.
I think it's our society, which is an unusually individualistic society, has singled out health as the area where we're going to be most paternalistic. I think that's appropriate given what's at stake. But I think it's that paternalism versus individualism, which is now pushed at the edge with things like the 23andMe tests.
Nita Farahani, come back on that.
So Hank is right. This is a fundamental disagreement that we have and that it's going to continue to divide society. So I think it is wonderful that we're having this transformation of society where individuals are empowered to be able to make decisions about their own health and that they're no longer in the position to be at the mercy of what a physician thinks is in their best interest to know. They actually get to know themselves. They get to learn themselves and they get to decide for themselves what it is that they want to go into their physicians and talk about. And so rather than being horrified at the idea that they are going into their doctor's offices and saying, hey, I've learned about my risk of Alzheimer's through my genetic predisposition information, and I'd like to know what kinds of preventive measures, if any, I can take, whether or not it makes sense for me to have an MRI at this point. I think what that really signals is a significant democratization of science and information and an empowerment of individuals in a way that is going to truly enable people to take charge of their own health, to be forced to learn what information means, to force physicians to actually be able to tell people what information means and not to leave it in the hands of a few to decide for the many.
And so is your argument then, it's not like if you get this information, you're going to leap to some medical intervention on your own. It's not like you're going to operate on yourself. There will be some intervention by the medical society at some point.
There is. I think the bigger fear is, for some people, is that you don't seek help, that you do make drastic decisions. Like, for example, 23andMe does report for you some things like your drug sensitivity and your likelihood of responding to different types of drugs. And the fear is that rather than going in and getting information from a physician or somebody qualified to interpret that, you discontinue the medication because of the 23andMe results. And I think that is a real concern, and it's a real concern that we need to safeguard against, not by prohibiting the flow of information, by increasing the information and the accessibility of information to individuals to understand the choices and the consequences of their choices.
Hank Greeley, would you be happier with 23andMe if they provided genetics counseling as well, that it wasn't just, here's all the results, Godspeed, but if they also said, here's what they mean, here's the person you can call at our office who can walk this through with you?
I'd be happiest if they required some sort of intervention, personal intervention with a trained professional, a genetic counselor or a clinical geneticist of some sort. I do think in the long run, and not very long run, when we all have a lot of genetic information, that's going to pose a huge challenge because there aren't enough genetic counselors in the world to counsel 310 million Americans or even 3.1 million Americans at this point.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say about this topic. Pat joins us first from Walnut Creek. Pat, go ahead.
Hi. I have my 23andMe information, and I'm planning to take it to Thanksgiving to share with my brothers, one of whom has just started into Parkinson's and of some sort. They can't quite figure out what kind, but I feel so comfortable going and talking with them about my 23andMe information, and I was planning to ask them to get it as well, just so we could compare. I have been assured by my 23andMe information that I probably have a very low chance of getting Parkinson's, but what I've had in the past was some autoimmune type things. And I've seen some medical literature starting to line up the alleles, the genes that might predispose one to autoimmune diseases. And so I'm watching, and I feel that I can take this information and watch the literature. 23andMe's website allows you to gain future information as more medical studies come out that line things up and keep me aware that I might should look for macular degeneration in my old age.
All right,
but
Pat,
I'm assured also that I don't have a big risk for Alzheimer's.
Yep, thank you. Pat, thanks for the call and comment. Let's get another one right away from Ram in San Jose. Ram, go ahead.
Hi, this is Ram. And your guest talked about device and the definition of a device and whether FDA has authority over that. And my question is, if I need a blood test and I go to Quest or LabCorp and they perform a test and they post the results, and if the FDA has jurisdiction over the entire process, and only then the results are then interpreted by a doctor, so how is this different from that process? And if that, if FDA has jurisdiction over the entire process, then why should they have jurisdiction over 23andMe process?
Ram, thank you. Hank Greeley, you want to take that?
Yeah, it's complicated, unfortunately. If something goes through a clinical laboratory, is sent in by a physician to a clinical laboratory, the FDA says we could regulate those tests, but we choose not to. Instead, they'll be regulated by something called CLIA, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments Act. If it's a test kit rather than going directly to a clinical laboratory from a physician, then the FDA says we're going to go ahead and regulate the kit. I do think that the two things underlying in an underlying sense, the two things are the same. And in one case, the FDA is deferring to this CLIA regulation, whereas in the other case where there is less clear regulation, the FDA wants to get involved directly.
Christina Farr, there's going to be sort of an infinite number of possibilities here with what can be regulated and what can't, right? With all the different new apps coming out, we heard from Nita Farhani about some of those possibilities. It's sort of endless what this could open up in terms of what's regulated and what isn't.
Yeah, it's funny how, in the last few days, a lot of people have been siding with the FDA. But in the last few months, they've been considered sort of the big bad wolf in healthcare and in Silicon Valley, just because of the sort of new crop of mobile health applications that we've seen pop up. And these are very innovative, using sort of the latest technologies. And the FDA has just looked at sort of 6,000 new applications on the App Store and Google Play and said, oh, God, we don't know what to do. And they kept demurring a guidance or a final guidance on how exactly they would regulate these applications until a few months ago. So now we have some clarity, and I think we're going to see sort of a boon in these new mHealth applications.
We heard our first caller say that she was totally happy with getting these results, eager to share them on Thanksgiving Day this week. But we have this other – here's another tweet from Debbie who writes, my Palo Alto doctor didn't know what to do with my 23andMe results. So it's a brave new world, Nita Farhani, isn't it? I mean, we're not only – there's not only this question of whether or not those taking the tests can interpret them properly. Debbie is saying her doctor didn't know what to do with the results.
Right. So that's going to happen more and more. I personally had my 23andMe profile done. My husband had it done. I had my parents had it done. They recently just got their results back as well. I've taken my results to several different physicians, some of whom didn't know about it. And the wonderful thing is I've educated them now. I've given them the information from 23andMe. They are now learning about it. And to Hank's point, we're going to have a substantial demand on individuals who need access to understand what this genetic information means. That's going to lead to more people going into genetic counseling. It's going to require doctors to become more sophisticated about the information. And the result is going to be that there's going to be a much more diffuse set of people who are going to be capable of understanding and interpreting this information. But there is a time period that we're going to go through where there's going to be some growing pains where people won't know what it means. They are going to have to, you know, learn to interpret the information and force themselves to become better educated.
Hank Greeley, what about that point that there's something fundamentally good about patients being well-armed with information, getting smarter, asking the right questions, sort of taking charge of their own bodies, their own health, that it's not like you don't want expertise, but it's better to start out smarter than to be totally reliant on those experts.
I think that's right. But everything in life is a trade-off. And I'm perfectly confident that Nita can figure out what her results mean and can even educate her doctors about what her results mean. But with all due respect, there aren't a lot of Nitas in our population. There are 310 million of us, and only a tiny percentage are going to be able to do that kind of interpretation and that kind of education of the doctors. Those are the people I'm worried about getting hurt by misinterpretations. Our caller said she's happy because she doesn't have a chance or she's very low risk for Alzheimer's. But 23andMe can't really tell her that. They can tell her. And with Parkinson's, they can tell her she doesn't have a particular allele that puts her at really, really high risk. Any information below that is really kind of iffy at this point.
Well, that's a fair point, isn't it, Nita Farahany? Because some of these things, even some genetic mutations that put you at risk for these various diseases, there's always this interaction between genes and the environment or other gene mutations that modify what one mutation does. There are all these different permutations. So it's very hard to know what exactly risk is. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely right. And Hank is right to be concerned that there is a low level of education in the general population right now about what genetic information actually means and how genes interact with the environment and with epigenetics and with other types of features. But one of the really wonderful things about what the caller said was that she's taking that information and it's requiring her, it's encouraging her to have a conversation with her brothers and with her family, which mm-hmm. means this is a conversation happening over Thanksgiving. It's happening over the dinner table. The kind of spreading and democratization of the science is happening through a mechanism like 23andMe. It wouldn't happen if doctors selectively decided which tests they were going to disclose and which ones they didn't.
Some comments coming in. One listener writes, I'm conflicted about this. I hate clamping down on new information in businesses, but to have bad data would be worse than to have none. And I have no idea about the accuracy here. Another writer puts it the opposite way. I object in the most vehement terms to this elitist paternalism on the part of the FDA bureaucrats that patients are too unsophisticated to understand information about their own bodies. Hank, really, make the defense
comment.
For elite paternalism.
I think that if you look at the 310 million of us, most of us are too unsophisticated to understand and act wisely about some of this information about our own bodies. Not only is bad information bad, but even good information, if it's misinterpreted and misapplied, can be bad. A woman who gets a test result saying she's not at very high risk for breast cancer, she has normal BRCA1 and 2 genes, who then decides, great, I don't need to get mammograms anymore, may have made a fatal mistake because her average her risk has gone from 12% to about 11.96%. Without someone to explain that to her, I'm afraid that there will be tragedies, and I would like to avoid that.
Do you think to some extent, Christina Farr, there's also something going on here generationally with the demographics, in particular here in Silicon Valley? You've got a couple decades to the junior of either Hank and me, or at least. Don't know about Nita. But do you think that's part of this, that people just view this differently and that there are younger people in particular are like, you know, fill me up with information. I can figure this out.
I think so. And, you know, the younger generation, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, we also very much buy into this messaging that we hear from 23andMe about the idea of 1 million souls and the power of all these people and the genetic information that they're collecting. So we want to be part of something bigger. And we've seen kind of the rise of crowdfunding movements and the sharing economy. And we want to be able to share our information with a company like 23andMe, which tells us that with our data, in the future, they're going to be able to make these research breakthroughs and potentially save lives.
Well, this gets us into a whole nother area of this, and I'd love to get your comments on this as well, starting with you, Anita Farhani. What Christina is suggesting is that something I know a number of, including the one that I have an affiliation with, the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, is especially interested, which is this opens up the possibility of not just doing, you know, clinical trial testing with 50 people, but with thousands, that you can get data from all these different sources and that it will increase our knowledge of diseases and lead to future breakthroughs. Is that future – well, tell me what you think of that future and whether or not that future is at risk if the FDA puts the clamps on this in the future.
So I think that future, which, you know, is loosely termed many times citizen science, is a promising one, which is, you know, individuals being able to contribute genetic information, other types of information, so that we can build our repository of samples that we're using and analysis we're doing at much higher powers and much higher levels. The only piece of that that really concerns me is making sure people understand the consequences. So we have pretty robust protections of human research subjects and protections when people give their samples through clinical research studies or through research studies. And through this kind of mechanism, those protections may not also exist. And so I'd want people to be really clear and understand what it means for their privacy, what it means for sharing of data. And to the extent that they are comfortable with doing so, then I think it's terrific. We also have to make sure that it leads to rigorous scientific research akin to the types of peer-reviewed research that we get through other and more standard means.
And is that the concern you would have, Hank, really, that it's – this sounds great, but if it's not great data, it's sort of garbage in, garbage out?
Right. I'd worry that 23andMe and similar companies aren't going to get the sort of good medical data that you would need to make a good interpretation of the genetic information. If you don't actually have good medical data from a person, but you have what they answer on a survey – you may get biases as well as errors. It's also the case, I think, in the not very distant future, we're going to get this massive research, but we're going to get it because the electronic health record has finally arrived. And a place like Kaiser Northern California with 3.5 million members, in a few years we'll have whole genome sequences as well as complete electronic health records on those 3.5 million members. That's going to give us, I think, the research boost. 23andMe might make a useful contribution. I'm a little skeptical, but it's worth exploring.
Let's go back to our callers. Bonnie joins us next in San Jose. Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I got to say, I love this conversation. It's one that my own family has had. My parents, actually baby boomers, did the 23andMe. And, you know, so this is something that's a frequent topic around our dinner table. But my question is a little bit different. You know, since the introduction of genetic testing into medical practices, I understand that there's kind of license holders and patents on genes and genetic variants that, you know, are somewhat under threat by this new introduction of information, genetic information. Do your guests think that maybe that might have played a role in the FDA's decision yesterday against 23andMe, and how might that all work out in the long run?
Hank Greeley.
So that's a very timely question. Just this year, earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled in a case involving Myriad Genetics that some aspects of genes of DNA could not be patented. We don't quite know how broad the implications are yet of that decision, but patents fairly suddenly in June became less important in the genetic world than they had been. And I don't think the FDA's decision really had anything to do with the patent side, but the patent side is worth watching.
Thanks for the call, Bonnie. A couple of other people want to get into this question about sort of who has power and what's at stake with that. Andres writes, no one's talking yet about how genetic information can actually empower people by providing them with more accurate information. This naturally takes away from the power of physicians. Historically, the FDA and other powerful medical and pharmaceutical boards don't want such efforts because it's diverted away from them. And Laura writes, your guest said that there are cases everywhere of people who want a double mastectomy because of 23andMe. I'm not sure anyone said everywhere, but we'll get into that. She goes on to say, I don't see how this can be a huge problem since doctors won't perform this operation without research on the patient. But more importantly, if the patient did have a great risk of breast cancer, perhaps the test got her to a doctor to be evaluated more carefully. What's the harm there? That would be sort of your point of view, right, Nita Farahany? If it gets you into the doctor's office, that's a good thing.
I think that's right. I think if it gets you into the doctor's office, that's a good thing. And, you know, frankly, it is the case that you can probably find some physician somewhere who will perform a test on you that you want. And there's a concern that many people have of medical overuse and, you know, people having medical procedures done that they shouldn't. I agree that physicians need to follow an ethical standard and to ensure that they're actually ordering tests that they think are necessary and that they are performing procedures that they think are valuable. I don't think it's an irrational choice for some women who have a long family history of breast cancer, who test positive for the BRCA gene variants, to have double mastectomies. For some limited subset of individuals, that could be a perfectly rational choice.
And that's where, though, this question of genetic counseling obviously becomes crucial, Hank Greeley.
Yeah, as well as the accuracy of the information. I think it could be a rational decision for some women to have a double mastectomy, but only if their information about their BRCA1 mutation is accurate and is quite clear, and if they get lots of good advice about it.
Karuna is next in San Francisco. Karuna, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call and covering this important issue. I'm the executive director of Breast Cancer Action. We were one of the co-plaintiffs on the BRCA case that went to the Supreme Court. And so we are, you know, breast cancer watchdog organization that absolutely believes that monopoly patents on DNA is wrong. At the same time, we recognize that all tests are not necessarily good tests. And I want to underscore this point, that for these tests to be useful, they must be properly validated and they ought to be peer-reviewed. And it's, you know, we actually can end up doing more harm than good by providing inaccurate information. One of your earlier callers, you know, called in to say she was happy to discuss her results at the Thanksgiving table, but she took for granted that the information that 23andMe was giving her was accurate. And so she felt, you know, she was a case in point of what happens when people get information and don't question the accuracy and validity of that information. I think the other point that I want to make that's very important is that 23andMe actually has a business model that allows them to collect all of this biodata at low cost. They provide this service, give people results, which, again, have not been peer-reviewed or validated, the topic of your conversation here, and then they have access to all of this biodata, which they are then able to use to develop. They started to branch out in their business model and think about what therapeutic and other business opportunities there are for them. At the same,
Karuna, let me hold you there, if I might. Sorry to jump in on you, but we're a bit short on time, and I appreciate both of the points you make. And Christina Farr, let me come back to you on the first point about this question of validity, because it's important to sort of slice this carefully. It's a question of both whether the data is valid, but as Hank Greeley has also added, it's the interpretation of that data that's so key.
Yeah, one of kind of the comments that a neurologist made to me yesterday that stuck with me is they create chaos and walk away. So she, you know, that was a comment she made based on just having patients come in and, you know, hand over test results, which they, you know, believe to be true, and want to sit down with their doctor and discuss kind of all the terrifying, potentially incurable diseases that they might have a high risk for.
Couple of comments I want to go, and then we'll get a couple of last comments. Ken writes, I use the 23andMe results for education, not for diagnosis. I use the data in the classroom. It's a great real-world example of what genetic testing can tell us. And Susan writes, the more I hear, the more I want this test. It just went on my Christmas list. So there you have it. Let's get your thoughts on where we go from here. Christine Farr, start us out on this. What are you going to be watching for as you continue to cover this story? What's the next step in this ongoing drama with 23andMe?
Well, I heard the statement, and that was the blanket statement that we got from 23andMe that you read out earlier in the show. The use of the word expectation was particularly interesting to me. They said we realize that we haven't met the FDA's expectations, and they did not use the term requirements or rules. So this suggests to me that they may choose to fight back, and they could call into question the FDA's original contention, which is that the Personal Genome Service and kit is even a medical device at all.
And Nita Farhani, what will you be watching? Just briefly, please.
I'll be watching the same thing, which is I think that this is going to be an interesting legal fight, not just over devices, but around the First Amendment and regulation of information. I'll be looking for substantially increased education, educational offerings, not just from 23, but from other companies more generally to enable people to be part of the conversation.
And Hank Greeley, I suspect a 23andMe test is not on your Christmas list, but what is? What would you like to see develop?
I'd like to see the FDA finally come out with their long-promised guidance about how they are going to regulate genetic tests. 23andMe really is an obsolete technology at this point. The SNP chips are being surpassed by whole genome sequencing. We need to figure out how we're going to regulate that, if we're going to regulate that, and I think how. That's not going to be easy, and the FDA needs to get guidance out for us to start that conversation.
And will 23andMe stay in business, do you think? I mean, how severe a problem will this be for them?
Hard to tell.
Maybe until they run out of money.
All right.
Their two competitors are no longer in the business.
Yeah. Hank Greeley, Director of the Center for Law and Biosciences and Professor of Law at Stanford University. Hank, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Nita Farhani, Professor at Duke University, thanks so much for being part of our program. Really appreciate your participation.
Enjoy the conversation.
And Christina Farr at VentureBeat, health reporter there. We'll continue to watch your reporting of this. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Earlier, we were also joined by Courtney Lias, the Director of Chemistry and Toxicology Devices at the FDA. I'm Dave Iverson. Thanks for being part of this edition of Forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, along with Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. Coming up in our next hour, we're going to have a conversation about someone who would have had his 300th birthday last Sunday, Father Junipero Serra. We'll talk about his legacy in California. That's coming up in our next hour of Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.